Neary finished writing in his summons book and gave the driver back his registration and license. Then he put his summons book back in his hip pocket and, with a forward motion of his hand, drew the .38 special. He put three bullets in Barzini's barrel chest before the other three men unfroze enough to dive for cover. By that time, Neary had darted into the crowd and around the corner where the car was waiting for him. The car sped up to 9th Avenue and turned downtown. Near Chelsea Park, Neary, who had discarded the cap and put on the overcoat and changed clothing, transferred to another car that was waiting for him. He had left the gun and the police uniform in the other car. It would be gotten rid of. An hour later, he was safely in the mall in Long Beach and talking to Michael Corleone. Tessio was waiting in the kitchen of the old Don's house and was sipping at a cup of coffee when Tom Hagen came for him. "Mike is ready for you now," Hagen said. "You better make your call to Barzini and tell him to start on his way." Tessio rose and went to the wall phone. He dialed Barzini's office in New York and said curtly, "We're on our way to Brooklyn." He hung up and smiled at Hagen. "I hope Mike can get us a good deal tonight." Hagen said gravely, "I'm sure he will." He escorted Tessio out of the kitchen and onto the mall. They walked toward Michael's house. At the door, they were stopped by one of the bodyguards. "The boss says he'll come in a separate car. He says for you two to go on ahead." Tessio frowned and turned to Hagen.
"Hell, he can't do that. That screws up all my arrangements."
At that moment, three more bodyguards materialized around them. Hagen said gently, "I can't go with you either, Tessio." The ferret-faced Capotagime understood everything in a flash of a second and accepted it. There was a moment of physical weakness, and then he recovered. He said to Hagen,
"Tell Mike it was business. I always liked him."
Hagen nodded. "He understands that." Tessio paused for a moment and then said softly,
"Tom, can you get me off the hook? For old time's sake?"
Hagen shook his head.
"I can't," he said.
He watched Tessio being surrounded by bodyguards and led into a waiting car. He felt a little sick. Tessio had been the best soldier in the Corleone family. The old Don had relied on him more than any other man, with the exception of Luca Brasi. It was too bad that so intelligent a man had made such a fatal error in judgment so late in life. Carlo Rizzi, still waiting for his interview with Michael, became jittery with all the arrivals and departures. Obviously, something big was going on, and it looked as if he were going to be left out. Impatiently, he called Michael on the phone. One of the house bodyguards answered, went to get Michael, and came back with a message that Michael wanted him to sit tight, that he would get to him soon. Carlo called up his mistress again and told her he was sure he would be able to take her to a late supper and spend the night. Michael had said he would call him soon. Whatever he had planned couldn't take more than an hour or two. Then it would take him about 40 minutes to drive to Westbury. It could be done. He promised her he would do it and sweet-talked her into not being sore. When he hung up, he decided to get properly dressed so as to save time afterward. He had just slipped into a fresh shirt when there was a knock on the door. He reasoned quickly that Mike had tried to get him on the phone and had kept getting a busy signal, so had simply sent a messenger to call him. Carlo went to the door and opened it. He felt his whole body go weak with terrible, sickening fear. Standing in the doorway was Michael Corleone, his face the face of that death Carlo Rizzi saw often in his dreams. Behind Michael Corleone were Hagen and Rocco Lamponi. They looked grave, like people who had come with the utmost reluctance to give a friend bad news. The three of them entered the house, and Carlo Rizzi led them into the living room. Recovered from his first shock, he thought that he had suffered an attack of nerves. Michael's words made him really sick, physically nauseous. "You have to answer for Santino," Michael said. Carlo didn't answer, pretended not to understand. Hagen and Lamponi had split away to opposite walls of the room. He and Michael faced each other. "You fingered Sonny for the Barzini people," Michael said, his voice flat. "That little farce you played out with my sister. Did Barzini kid you? That would fool a Corleone?" Carlo Rizzi spoke out of his terrible fear, without dignity, without any kind of pride. "I swear I'm innocent. I swear on the head of my children. I'm innocent. Mike, don't do this to me, please. Mike, don't do this to me." Michael said quietly, "Barzini is dead. So is Philip Tattaglia. I want to square all the family accounts tonight. So don't tell me you're innocent. It would be better for you to admit what you did." Hagen and Lamponi stared at Michael with astonishment. They were thinking that Michael was not yet the man his father was. Why try to get this traitor to admit guilt? That guilt was already proven, as much as such a thing could be proven. The answer was obvious. Michael still was not that confident of his right, still feared being unjust, still worried about that fraction of an uncertainty that only a confession by Carlo Rizzi could erase. There was still no answer. Michael said almost kindly, "Don't be so frightened. Do you think I'd make my sister a widow? Do you think I'd make my nephews fatherless? After all, I'm godfather to one of your kids." "No, your punishment will be that you won't be allowed any work with the family. I'm putting you on a plane to Vegas to join your wife and kids, and then I want you to stay there. I'll send Connie an allowance. That's all. But don't keep saying you're innocent. Don't insult my intelligence and make me angry. Who approached you, Tattaglia or Barzini?" Carlo Rizzi, in his anguished hope for life, in the sweet flooding relief that he was not going to be killed, murmured, "Barzini." "Good, good," Michael said softly. He beckoned with his right hand. "I want you to leave now. There's a car waiting to take you to the airport." Carlo went out the door first, the other three men very close to him. It was night now, but the mall, as usual, was bright with floodlights. A car pulled up. Carlo saw it was his own car. He didn't recognize the driver. There was someone sitting in the back, but on the far side. Lamponi opened the front door and motioned to Carlo to get in. Michael said, "I'll call your wife and tell her you're on your way down." Carlo got into the car. His silk shirt was soaked with sweat. The car pulled away, moving swiftly toward the gate. Carlo started to turn his head to see if he knew the man sitting behind him. At that moment, Clemenza, as cunningly and daintily as a little girl slipping a ribbon over the head of a kitten, threw his garrote around Carlo Rizzi's neck. The smooth rope cut into the skin with Clemenza's powerful yanking throttle. Carlo Rizzi's body went leaping into the air like a fish on a line, but Clemenza held him fast, tightening the garrote until the body went slack. Suddenly there was a foul odor in the air of the car. Carlo's body, sphincter released by approaching death, had voided itself. Clemenza kept the garrote tight for another few minutes to make sure, then released the rope and put it back in his pocket. He relaxed himself against the seat cushions as Carlo's body slumped against the door. After a few moments, Clemenza rolled the window down to let out the stink. The victory of the Corleone family was complete. During that same 24-hour period, Clemenza and Lamponi turned loose the regimes and punished the infiltrators of the Corleone domains. Neri was sent to take command of the Tessio regime. Barzini bookmakers were put out of business. Two of the highest-ranking Barzini enforcers were shot to death as they were peaceably picking their teeth over dinner in an Italian restaurant on Mulberry Street. A notorious fixer of trotting races was also killed as he returned home from a winning night at the track. Two of the biggest Shylocks on the waterfront disappeared, to be found months later in the New Jersey swamps. With this one savage attack, Michael Corleone made his reputation and restored the Corleone family to its primary place in the New York families. He was respected not only for his tactical brilliance, but because some of the most important caporegimes in both the Barzini and Tattaglia families immediately went over to his side. It would have been a perfect triumph for Michael Corleone, except for an exhibition of hysteria by his sister Connie. Connie had flown home with her mother, the children left in Vegas. She had restrained her widow's grief until the limousine pulled into the mall. Then, before she could be restrained by her mother, she ran across the cobbled street to Michael Corleone's house. She burst through the door and found Michael and Kay in the living room. Kay started to go to her, to comfort her and take her in her arms in a sisterly embrace, but stopped short when Connie started screaming at her brother, screaming curses and reproaches.
"You lousy bastard," she shrieked. "You killed my husband. You waited until our father died and nobody could stop you, and you killed him. You killed him. You blamed him about Sonny. You always did. Everybody did. But you never thought about me. You never gave a damn about me. What am I going to do now? What am I going to do?"
She was wailing. Two of Michael's bodyguards had come up behind her and were waiting for orders from him. But he just stood there impassively and waited for his sister to finish. Kay said in a shocked voice, "Connie, you're upset. Don't say such things." Connie had recovered from her hysteria. Her voice held a deadly venom.
"Why do you think he was always so cold to me? Why do you think he kept Carlo here in the mall? All the time he knew he was going to kill my husband. But he didn't dare while my father was alive. My father would have stopped him. He knew that. He was just waiting. And then he stood godfather to our child, just to throw us off the track. The cold-hearted bastard. You think you know your husband? Do you know how many men he had killed with my Carlo? Just read the papers. Barzini and Tattaglia and the others. My brother had them killed."
She had worked herself into hysteria again. She tried to spit in Michael's face, but she had no saliva. "Get her home and get her a doctor," Michael said. The two guards immediately grabbed Connie's arms and pulled her out of the house. Kay was still shocked, still horrified. She said to her husband, "What made her say all those things, Michael? What makes her believe that?" Michael shrugged. "She's hysterical." Kay looked into his eyes.
"Michael, it's not true. Please say it's not true."
Michael shook his head wearily. "Of course it's not. Just believe me, this one time I'm letting you ask about my affairs and I'm giving you an answer. It is not true." He had never been more convincing. He looked directly into her eyes. He was using all the mutual trust they had built up in their married life to make her believe him. And she could not doubt any longer. She smiled at him ruefully and came into his arms for a kiss.
"We both need a drink," she said.
She went into the kitchen for ice, and while there heard the front door open. She went out of the kitchen and saw Clemenza, Neri, and Rocco Lamponi come in with the bodyguards. Michael had his back to her, but she moved so that she could see him in profile. At that moment, Clemenza addressed her husband, greeting him formally.
"Don Michael," Clemenza said.
Kay could see how Michael stood to receive their homage. He reminded her of statues in Rome. Statues of those Roman emperors of antiquity who by divine right held the power of life and death over their fellow men. One hand was on his hip. The profile of his face showed a cold, proud power. His body was carelessly, arrogantly at ease, weight resting on one foot, slightly behind the other. The caporegimes stood before him. In that moment, Kay knew that everything Connie had accused Michael of was true. She went back into the kitchen and wept.